and the progressive side is really wanting to lean into it. So we'll see how.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm all for it. If you guys want to lean into it and splinter your party,
I mean, run another election on it. Great.
I'm fine.
I
You
welcome
want to
it.
take if you want to take Tim Walz's
Cheers.
advice, do that.
Run Tim Walz again. That would be a great idea. I strongly support that.
Welcome to Rivera and Reeves, the podcast where we break through the bias, report the news, and occasionally trip over our soapboxes while ranting about the headlines.
Every week, we tackle the biggest stories with sharp analysis, unfiltered honesty, and just enough sarcasm to keep it fun.
So pull up a chair, grab your coffee, and join us as we wade through the spin, because the media is trash and we have zero patience for their nonsense.
Hey, friends, and welcome to another episode of Rivera and Reeves. I'm Mercedes, and I'm here with my friend Rachel. Say hello, Rachel.
Hello, Rachel.
Well, today I'm very excited because not only am I here with my friend Rachel, but I am here to introduce you to a new friend, Amanda Peterson of Amanda Talks Geopolitics. And I have been following Amanda for some time on TikTok. Remember last episode I talked about how I lurk around on TikTok? Because
yes,
I don't
on
partake.
The talk.
I just lurk. But we're going to talk with Amanda, and we're going to talk about geopolitics because that's what she talks about. And it's not something that I'm a particular expertise in, and neither is Rachel. So we thought we would bring a friend. Welcome, Amanda.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to do this.
Thank you for being here. This is exciting.
I like to also give Amanda a little bit of exposure because even though she's on TikTok, she is also on Instagram, where she, I think you cross-pollinate yourself, right?
Yeah, I need to create a better strategy of what to do on there. I'm just so not like an Instagram user. The main platforms I've been prioritizing are obviously my TikTok. I'm building up a YouTube and Twitter. So if you want my,
well, look at you.
Yeah, if you
gosh,
want
I can barely life. Keep up with one.
Well, if you, for sure, I will be leaving the link in the show notes so you guys can go follow her if you are on the talk. I recommend that you go and follow her there. She also engages in some debate over there, which I do lurk in your debates, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
And those are also very interesting. But today we're going to talk geopolitics. Before we do that, let me give you a reminder that you should click that follow button to make sure you don't miss another episode. And because we're going to be your new favorite podcast, you're going to give us a 5-star rating. You're going to go ahead and you're going to do it now. All right, let's talk.
The pleasantries are gone. We just demand people.
I'm like, you're going to do it right now. Okay. So we need to talk about, first of all, I just kind of want to set the stage. And we brought you in to talk geopolitics, specifically, like, what is Trump's foreign policy? Like, do you see, because a lot of times you see someone, like, coming up with, like, the Bush doctrine, the Obama mm-hmm. doctrine. There's always, like, this phrase of, like, the doctrine. So the Trump doctrine appears to be kind of taking shape. And it seems a little different from his first term. And I don't know if that is because it's actually different or because he actually has people working with him in this administration versus as opposed to against him in the previous one. But how would you kind of define what Trump is trying to do this time around?
It's funny because Trump, for casual observers, it looks like he's very incoherent. Like, well, he's an isolationist, but he wants to take Greenland. And what are we doing with Canada and Middle East? And I actually think it's a pretty coherent strategy. I think that he pretty much everything you can understand he's done up to we're just under 100 days in. It's all to counter China. And so if you look at it through the lens of Russia, Ukraine, it might seem like it's not really making sense. Middle East doesn't really make sense. It's all just to counter China. Canada is to counter China. The Panama Canal, which nobody's talking about.
Which is weird that nobody's talking about it because it is a humongous deal.
Yeah, it's a huge deal. It might even be good that we're not talking about it so much because I think that we don't want to be so adversarial and openly hostile to China. We don't want to egg them on. We don't want to make it seem like we're going to. Xi Jinping usually talks about the United States as if we're going, he uses the term, we're going to choke. Like they're trying to choke us. Well, we don't want to choke them. We don't want to be adversarial to them. We'll allow them to have open markets and all of these things, but we won't allow them to choke us, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's the best way to explain what Trump's foreign policy has been, basically countering China, Getting rid of choke points like the Panama Canal. 40% of our imports and exports go through the Panama Canal. We built it. American blood, sweat, and tears built it. And then Jimmy Carter sold it back to them for a dollar. And then all of a sudden, China owns it and is charging us to use it. And had we ever gotten into an openly like hostile conflict with us, they could have just said, don't let American ships through there anymore. So now that's not happening anymore. That's a really good thing.
So that can I ask you a question about how, if he's looking at every decision he's making foreign policy wise with China in mind, how do you see his handling of the Ukraine-Russia conflict? Specifically, I would love to know your opinions and thoughts about the Oval Office interaction between Zelensky and President Trump. And how do you think Trump's handling of that is specifically holding China off? What do you think his end goal with that? I mean, it's easy to say he just wants peace, but what specifically is he trying to kind of target in that discussion and his our involvement in that to hold off China?
So, okay, totally. This is like a really good question. There's kind of two frames of reference.
He looks so excited.
I could geek up talking about this for a long time. I'm kind of a dork, but there's kind of two models when we talk about foreign policy today. There's like premises and restrainers or realists. Trump probably is more in the realist camp. Premises are the people that you see all the time on the news. So they are often called like neocons. I don't like that term. But premises would say that we need to counter every single adversary we have, and we need to be very like not give them one inch. And therefore, that will tell China, hey, if you try and take Taiwan, if you try and get adversarial, hostile, anything like that, being that we took care of Russia so quickly and efficiently, and we didn't allow Putin to get what he wanted, we would do that to you. Just because we countered Iran in this way, so we would do that to you, China.
So like more of a tit for tat type of thing. If you do this, we'll do that.
Well, not even necessarily tit for tat, but just, hey, China, do you see what we just did to Russia? We didn't let Putin get his way. We would not let you get your way, Xi Jinping.
So threatening. Yeah. Okay.
I think that a lot of Trump's advisors, namely like Bridge Colby, who is the, I don't think he's been confirmed yet, but he will be the chief strategist for the Defense Department. I think that more realists, and I would put myself in that camp, view this as, you know, we need to make a bunch of tough decisions in the United States. We don't have a military that can compete in two theaters right now. We've wasted a lot of time in the Middle East. So we can't be, you know, constantly dragged into other things in the Middle East all the time. We don't want to get involved in Africa anymore because China kind of owns Africa. And Russia has like a big presence there. We can't get bogged down with the Russia-Ukraine war. We need Europe to start pulling their weight. This has been like talked about in American foreign policy circles for 30 years, by the way. And the Europeans don't pull their weight.
Well, and that was one of the things that I was going to kind of ask too in relation to that, because Russia-Ukraine brings in Europe. And there's been a lot of discussion too, especially Nikki Haley, literally yesterday, I think, or something like that. Like she posted something about how during 9/11, we needed our friends. And so we need to make sure that we keep our friends. And she's specifically, she's referring to Europe.
Yeah, which is true.
It's like, we can't be too arrogant to think that we don't need friends. Do you see what Trump is doing as like inherently
isolating
like
us from
isolating us, alienating us from our friends, or it's just like we need better friends and you guys need to behave better?
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. We need better friends. I mean, all throughout the Cold War, we had this posture with our allies, which kind of went away when the Soviet Union dissolved. And it was no longer that all of our allies need to pull their own weight. Instead, we will just be the world's policeman. Well, that put us in this really awkward position where our European counterparts no longer spent on their defense. They built up welfare states, and then they were critical of our foreign policy moves. So they told us for 25, 30 years, well, America, you shouldn't be doing this. Well, you shouldn't be doing that. Well, and now they're like, well, we have this existential crisis and we're not in a position to spend on it. We're not in a position. Germany has less divisions ready to go for a war today than they did when Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022. That's unacceptable. I mean, we're begging them to spend the mandatory minimum of 2% on their defense spending. What the minimum. They claim that there's this existential threat. I agree that Russia is like a very big threat to them, but we can't be the ones. We're supposed to be the backstop. And NATO, for a long time, because we didn't hold them accountable, has made us the forefront. And we need to maintain like the backstop again, basically.
So we've been operating in like a post-World War II kind of framework where we were, but so much has changed. That's inoperable. We can't do that anymore. This isn't going to work. And I, you know, it makes me think about Michael Schellenberger, the journalist. He did a video right after the blow up in the Oval Office, which I still want to hear what you have to think about that.
Sorry.
But just so many juicy details to talk about.
Yeah.
But he did a short video, I think, from his car where everybody was just laying on their disdain for Trump and Vance so quickly and how ridiculous it is that America would expect a thank you or have some sort of expectation of reciprocal gratitude or action from the UK, Europe, writ large, whatever. And what he basically said was, you guys over there, you don't take us seriously. You make fun of us. You think that we're kind of ridiculous. And yet we have taken care of you for decades and decades and decades. And you expect us to. We need to rework this relationship. Like, we need to break up for a little bit. We maybe need to find better friends.
We need to take time.
Take some time apart and think, because we're operating under this framework of a world that's totally gone. It's totally changed and it's reorganized. So what do you think about that? And what do you think about this new administration coming in here and kind of going, all right, we're going to shake some stuff up, specifically when it comes to Ukraine and Russia?
Well, so I think that that meeting was interesting because you're right. Like, everybody who hates Trump looked at it and they were like, God, Trump was just awful. I actually thought he was kind of the adult in the room there. I think Vance was more adversarial. Yeah. And then, you know, people who hate Ukraine were like, oh, my God, how dare Zelensky do that? It's an interesting point of contention. Apparently, Zelensky's been like that behind the scenes for a long time with readers.
Yeah.
But here we see it out in the open. And what's interesting about like Trump's, how he's handling Russia, Ukraine right now, there was a report that was done by our security establishment in January 2023. It was put out through the Army War College, I believe. Then it was made public in 2024. It is now, we're recording this at the end of March 2025. That report basically said the war is going to end not with an outright Ukraine victory. They will not retain their their 1991 borders. And it will be some sort of Korean War style disengagement. And that's what's going to happen. Every time Tony Blinken went over to Kyiv and was like playing his guitar and like pretending he's Mick Jagger, he was negotiating essentially the same points that Trump is negotiating right now. So the difference is A, the language that Trump uses to negotiate and to speak about this conflict in public, which some can say is shameful. Some can say is like, we should be allied with Russia. I definitely don't think that. And then the other thing is that Trump actually got them to the table. You know, I mean, right now, Russia's in a better position than it was when that report was put out in January 2023. Their economy's on a trajectory to do better. All of those things. If we understand that we're unwilling to allow Ukraine because we don't want to supply the weapons, we don't want to supply the political capital for them to regain all of their territory, the best thing we could do now is end it and end it quickly and put Ukraine in a good position where they have American investment moving forward. And our European counterparts are like, no, we're taking this seriously now. Next time Russia comes knocking, because they probably will, you have to be prepared. Our Western or our Eastern European allies understand this. It's the West. Like in American politics, we want to have a hero. And Biden wasn't much of one because he was barely around. I mean, he wasn't like,
They made it Zelensky.
They made it Zelensky. And so, oh my God, what are we going to do about our hero? And I feel he's shown a lot of bravery. I feel very bad for him, but it's not.
You're so much nicer to the Sani and I. We're like, we don't. Not
like,
at all.
Like, no, dude, stop.
Just put on a tie.
We were going to talk about this a little bit later, but since we're already on the subject, just real quick to like tie up this subject. You know, so far we've gotten like, there's some quasi little ceasefires. I think the Black Sea and the energy infrastructure Reports are Treasury still over there trying to negotiate a mineral deal. I'm not sure exactly how that ties in with, like, we have our suspicion that it's just about having a U.S. presence there, which will work as an added deterrent as opposed to just having, like, military there. And then Ukraine has said that they're willing to do a 30-day ceasefire, and Russia seems to be kind of dragging their feet. Like, will this eventually get tied up, and will it hold past Trump?
It probably won't hold past Trump. I do think some sort of a deal will get done. I think if Putin starts dragging his feet, and this is what I don't understand with Zelensky, I mean, if he had just waited it out and kind of said what Trump wanted him to say, he would have just given him way more weapons because he would get annoyed with Putin. I think the overall strategy right now, when we talk about the mineral deal, like, the mineral deal really is because rare earth minerals are going to become the next oil, basically, like the race for oil. Because in the race for AI, we want to compete and beat China by 2030, which is when they want to have beaten us in the AI race. We need rare earth minerals to be able to do that. And so there's a bunch of them that just happen to be in Ukraine. A lot of them are in Russian occupied areas. But, you know, so
semantics.
We have that deal. And so if the need arose for those minerals, we have a place that we can get them, and we have an actual, like, alliance in that way. But then also encountering China, and these are kind of the two. And, like, I have a big question mark on this. But to me, the deal with Russia long term is to try and strip them away from China. So right now, Russia and Iran and China and North Korea, but they're the weakest of the four, are all kind of together acting as one. And we want to strip, not entirely, but allow for there to be air between Russia and China and Iran and China, because China's not energy independent, but it can get that energy from the Russians, from the Chinese, from the Canadians, and they can get, Russia makes a bunch of fertilizer, which China can use to maintain its food supply. If we were ever in an all-out conflict, which God forbid we never are, I don't think that we will be, or we should be worried about that, but you want to make sure that on the table, we could get the Russians to not sell that fertilizer to China if we're trying to blockade that and stuff like that.
So, but you think that eventually there will, like, Putin will come to the table and agree to a ceasefire, or they'll come to some kind of peace treaty or something like that? You just don't know.
Not
if it'll
a lasting
hold past.
Not a lasting. I think from everybody I talk to who's in the know, everybody wants a ceasefire right now. We want a ceasefire. Mm-hmm. We don't want to keep giving weapons. The Ukrainians, it's not as bad as Russian military bloggers make it seem, but they do face a manpower shortage that could have really bad effects on their economy. And the Russians want to replenish their stockpiles and stuff as well. So, yeah, I don't think it'll be a lasting peace necessarily, but it would be tolerable for now. And if we can, after that ceasefire is in place, if we can get the Europeans more on track, then that can have a deterrent effect that would make Putin give second guess.
Which I think is, like, the ultimate goal is to hope that the Europeans will start taking more responsibility. And then Russia will be more reluctant. Also, yes. I mean, how old is Putin? I mean, I don't know who's coming up next, but Putin, I don't know, like 100 years old. So
he's old.
How much longer is he going to last? Well, I don't know if he's Biden old, but he's old.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody in politics is Biden old. Like, that was
old. All right. Well, I want to move on to your personal favorite subject, which is in regards to Syria. So Assad's regime was toppled, leaving a vacuum in Syria. People were fighting with each other, and it looks like the top dog, at least in the West, and this is a summation of, like, a very, very simple summation, was, what's his name? Ahmad al-Shara? Is that correct?
Well, there's two different ways to say it.
Yeah,
I remember we talked
about. There you go. Yeah. Thank you. With HTS. See, like, it's not my jam, okay? That's why you're here. Now, about 2 weeks ago, there were reports of HTS attacking religious minorities. But you had just reported this morning, I think you talked on your TikTok about, I guess, a proclamation about, like, not proselytizing. So my question is, in the region, like, you know, there was a lot of debate about, with the toppling of Assad, who was going to fill the vacuum. Now, who appears to be taking the lead has been portrayed as a moderate, or has been at least hopeful as a moderate, or trying to moderate himself. I don't know how true that is. And then the concern is that that actually wasn't true because of the reports that happened about 2 weeks ago. So what is actually going on now? What is this new, like, proclamation? And did I describe the players correctly, or do I need to be corrected?
For the most part, So what happened, Bashar al-Assad was like a brutal dictator of Syria for the last 20 or so years. I think he came to power around like when his dad died in 2000. His dad was elected in 1972, I think, but double check now these dates, around the 1970s for, I think it was the 4-year term. He stayed in 30 years. Then he passed it down to his son. He was supposed to pass it down to his one son, but that son was killed. Bashar was kind of like a loser ophthalmologist in London. He moves back to Syria. He takes over.
What are those loser ophthalmologists?
Well, he that's how he's always been seen.
Well, expected to be the inherited leader.
Yeah.
Like,
never.
That was not for him.
Right. And after the Arab Spring, they tried to take his regime down. Russia and Iran really stepped in and helped him. And after Israel kind of gutted Iran's proxies over the last year and a half, it's kind of interesting. Back like last fall, the leader of Turkey, Erdogan, was trying to negotiate with Bashar al-Assad because he wanted to push back Syrian Democratic Forces, which is the Kurdish group that the U.S. actually backs, which he considers the Syrian version of the PKK, which is a Turkish terrorist group that's trying to separate and have there be a Kurdish state in half of Turkey. He wanted to push the SDF back from their border. Assad would not negotiate with him. And so Erdogan told Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, led by Jelani, HTS, hey, just go in and take Aleppo. Well, HTS did so. And they realized that the Syrian army were paper tigers and the Russians were bogged down and the Iranians were like gutted. And so they just marched all the way down to Damascus and took over all of Syria, which is like crazy because nobody like it was such a bloody, awful, couple years in the middle of that 15-year civil war. Nobody thought that this would happen and it happened. And so now we're all just kind of sitting on pins and needles like, so what's going to happen? Because Hayat Tahrir al-Sham is an off branch of Al-Qaeda and ISIS. So a lot of their fighters were previously affiliated with Al-Qaeda and ISIS. We don't like those guys. So what's going to happen? My belief, and this is just a personal opinion, I think Islamism, so political Islam, has iterated. I think after really the toppling of ISIS, but also the failure of the Arab Spring, which were supposed to be democratic uprisings all throughout the Middle East, that was going to turn them all into democracies and really just made all of the countries that these.
And this was during Obama for people who don't know.
Yeah.
Like little mini Americas everywhere.
And it
was like obviously never going to happen.
Which was never going to happen. And it actually just made life worse in a lot of those countries. Mm-hmm. Maybe Syria the most, but also Yemen with the Houthis now. I mean, a lot of these groups. They no longer favor like Islamic fundamentalism, which was the kind of paradigm since the 1990s favored throughout the Middle East. And instead they favor like security and stability. They want to look to the Gulf states as a model. And I think you really see that with Ahmed al-Shara or Jelani's, like, his speeches that he's giving and stuff. So what happened 2 weeks ago, and it's really hard to follow the Syrian conflict because every different group acts like their opponent are either Zionists, funded by the Zionists, funded by the United States. None of those things are popular over there. Or it was funded by Iran. And so it's really hard to tell. Are they just...
Well, it's a war of propaganda.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business and sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
Yeah. So it's really hard.
Well, but... and the press over here is confused.
Yeah.
I mean, within 10 minutes on Instagram the other day, I was told that none of the people who died in Syria were Christians. That was talking points.
Kind of true. Yeah.
And then other people are telling me, I am here. I'm press. And it was. They were targeted. Christians were targeted. So I'm like, well, in America, we're all very confused.
Yeah.
You know?
So... I mean, you're going to hear a bunch of different things from a bunch of different people. In my opinion,
right.
The Assad regime was never going to be able to rule long term. because he was just so awful and brutal. He was never going to be able to get full control of Syria again. This new guy, Jilani, wants Syria to be ruled as one. What's interesting is both Israel wants it to kind of be balkanized and the Islamic regime in Iran wants it to be balkanized. So that's kind of interesting because they're competitors. And Turkey would like it to remain as one. So Jilani is trying to go get all of these separatist groups to turn in their weapons and kind of fold into the new Syrian one state. They're going to release the government parameters tomorrow, March 29th, on like Saturday night over there. And they're going to have a woman representative. They're going to have Christians represented. They're going to have all these things. And we're going to be this like kind of liberal democracy. Probably not, but we're hoping for stability here, not democracy. What happened 2 weeks ago is the Alawites would not turn in their weapons to Jilani, and Jilani's guys, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, who were previously affiliated with like Al-Qaeda, acted like we know Al-Qaeda acts to try and get the weapons back from the Alawites. And over 1,000 people died. And if you watch the videos, they're saying these are Shia. They're Alawite.
Is that because Assad aligned with Alawites?
Yeah. He's an Alawite. A lot of his previous regime was made up of Alawites. So,
okay. So do you think this new dude, what's his name again?
Ahmed al-Shara.
That guy.
Yeah.
If it was Spanish, it would be very simple for me, right? Is he the moderate that they're trying to, because he's had affiliations with other groups that like the United States don't like. Mm-hmm. So
we have designated HTS currently as a terrorist organization. Yeah. We have sanctions down.
Yeah, but our media here all rejoiced when Assad was toppled. This is the best thing.
Yeah.
They're ushering in some new moderate. And I'm not saying it's not. He was horrible. But they're making it sound like this is a vast improvement and that this guy is a total political moderate, where a lot of us are going, I don't think that this is super great either.
We just don't know if it's worse or better. Do you know what I mean?
Like, I mean, we understood the status quo under Assad. Yeah. We don't know what the status quo will be long term under Jilani or al-Shara. But I get my position on this is that Assad was never going to be able to rule Syria long term again. Like it was too broken up. I mean, Jilani ran Idlib, which is like a region in Syria for a long time. It was pretty Islamist. He's not seeming that way now. Do we see them mandate a hijab? Do we see them? I don't know.
Well, and then specifically in this proclamation where you had said that he
banning proselytizing. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, isn't that significant, too? Because, generally, when you're talking about Islamism, it's like either you submit or you're dead. You know what
exactly.
I mean? Like in the most extreme measures. So does that also give us a sign of what he's hoping to do for the future?
It might. I mean, so he did something, too, where he invited the Syrian Jewish population back to Syria. They all fled around the 90s and they were like really a friend who's a part of that community. A lot of them live in Brooklyn now. He invited them back to CC. We're inviting our Jewish population back. We want them to come and be free here. Is it for the cameras and to show, hey, I'm a moderate, or is it real? I don't think any of the Syrian Jewish community is planning on running back. Assad did the same thing. He would post, oh, look at me being so nice to all these Christians. I mean, the Assad regime killed more Christians than Hayat Tahrir al-Sham has. It's a difficult, to me, we should look at it with like, I'm looking at it kind of optimistically. I see like good in those proclamations, but I'm not saying that because I trust Jilani. I'm saying that because I think that Islamism has iterated. I think that we're no longer seeing these overt displays of fundamentalism being favored in the Middle East. I think we're seeing a desire for security and stability being what is favored by these government groups and aspiring governments.
Is that similar, or do you think you're seeing a version of that with the reported protests that have been happening in Gaza?
Maybe. I think if we see good come from Syria and the Palestinians see, okay, there could be this stable government that could take hold. We don't want to live through this war again, so we'll maybe favor that if they can see evidence of it. I mean, it's kind of hard because I think, especially with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, people are so absolutist. It's either like you are a strict Zionist or you are a terror. And it's like, so none of those people in Gaza are going to become Zionists tomorrow. You know what I mean? Like that's not going to happen.
That's not
going to
happen.
they don't like Israel, but they don't want to be led by Hamas. And Steve Witkoff said something in his interview with Tucker Carlson. Oh, we just need to have elections. No elections. No elections in Gaza. No.
That's because last time, look what happened.
And that was probably the biggest failure of the Bush administration is allowing elections in Gaza. No, no elections. We're going to put in a stable puppet government and maybe and they have good relations with the Gulf states and a massive flow of aid comes in. I don't think that that's going to be what happens in Gaza, but maybe in the West Bank. I don't know.
Okay, well, then speaking of Gaza,
yeah.
Because there was like a whole, obviously, Gaza is rubble currently, mm-hmm. right now.
A lot of
you
it.
Know, and something has to happen with the area, with this very small area after the war. Will Israel take the lead? Will Egypt take the lead? Is this claim or this...
Gaza Lago. Is it going to happen?
Yeah. Is Gaza Lago going to happen? Is that a threat? So like, because the rest of the region doesn't want the United States to have a permanent presence there. And so they're like...
Well, and I'm curious, do you think all of these kind of like land grab comments that Trump makes, do you think that they are all part of his doctrine where he's got, we're taking back the Panama Canal, we're going to Greenland and we're taking it. We want to be in Ukraine doing like the rare earth minerals. We're going to also put up a Trump Tower at Gaza and all these different things. Do you feel like that's strategic or is that just Trump being Trump?
It's strategic. So the Greenland thing is Russia has a massive presence up in the Arctic that we need to counter. The doomsday scenario that we're preparing for is that Russia has their nuclear-enabled submarines parked up under the Arctic. They can hit any city on the eastern seaboard and threaten us with a nuclear weapon that way. And we would either have to absorb that or capture that nuclear warhead somehow, which is why Trump talks about buying the Iron Dome from Israel.
Yeah.
And then we would be invaded on by China on the west. That's like doomsday scenario. That's why we want to drive Russia and China apart. China also came up with this definition, a near Arctic power.
What does that even mean?
It would, they say that, so if you have an ocean on your border that touches the Arctic, like we do, like Canada does, like Russia does, then you have some claim up in the Arctic. While China is saying since they touch an ocean that touches the Arctic Ocean, that they have a claim as well. And they're trying to like get in up there for minerals and mining and all that stuff. So we need to counter that. So that's why we're talking about Greenland. Basically, if we are going to be the first line of defense and not the last line of defense, why don't we just get the strategic, like, we already have bases up in Greenland. Why don't we just take care of the whole thing and get the mineral deals and everything? Denmark's not going to do anything, so we will. That's kind of why we're talking about that.
Well, do you think it's going to happen, and do you want it to?
I do think it will happen.
I think it'll happen, too.
Yeah, I think
it's... Are you guys serious?
Yeah.
This administration is blowing my mind, and I think we have been so bored with politics for so long that all of a sudden stuff's, like, moving, like, rapid.
Well, he's
fire.
Clearly in an expansionist
And he's very motivated with Greenland specifically.
Well, and I thought it was really funny because, like, I'm being Puerto Rican, just like a few weeks ago, there was like conversation of maybe Puerto Rico finally being independent and that they were having a meeting with Susie Wiles or whatever. And I'm like, that's not going to happen because of Puerto Rico's proximity to Latin America and Cuba and all that kind of stuff. There's no freaking, and he's in expansionist mode. Like, he's trying to get Greenland. There's no freaking way he's going to let go of Puerto Rico anytime soon.
Well, this doesn't mean like, that these become states. They can remain territories where we're not giving them two senators. Like that, it is.
No.
Like, yeah, no, we're not doing that.
No, we will not.
Yeah, you guys can't see me. My eyes bugged. I'm like, absolutely not. So,
yeah. But I do think that he'll get Greenland. And I just think even like from a domestic political standpoint, the Democrats came in saying that he's going to like go after all of his enemies and stuff. Well, by adopting this expansionist attitude, he's making us like think outward versus like inward. And I actually think that's a good thing. In terms of Gaza.
That's what I was about to say. That expansionist attitude, like, does it extend to Gaza or is it like,
It's different.
The Middle East needs to get their, you know, stuff together also. And so he's mm-hmm. using that as like motivation for them to hopefully, you know, for the Gulf states and stuff and everybody to kind of come in and help manage the situation. Kind of what he's doing with the Europeans and Ukraine. It's just a different strategy, obviously, because it's a different dynamic.
I think that it's partially a negotiating ploy, but also if you look at what the Gulf states, why they're willing to enter into the Abraham Accords and what they really want from us, they want American security and assurances so that they can become insurable. Right now, if there's any, like, we take things like property rights for granted here, but like, if you have property rights, you can buy insurance. And then if your house comes and gets flooded or something, insurance will pay to rebuild it. Right now, most of the Middle East, with how unstable and chaotic it is, and Iran expanding using these proxies and stuff, they're not insurable. They don't have like deterrence. There's only two American allies in the Middle East that can project power outside of its borders, Israel and Turkey. So they'll kind of talk to Turkey. They'll kind of talk to, and then Iran can extend. Obviously, it has a proxy network, but
that is fascinating to me, because that concept, that idea would never like have occurred to me that it's, mm-hmm. you know, it makes sense. Like, why would anybody want to invest in these regions mm-hmm. if you don't know what's going to happen and you have no insurance and you have no assurance that it's going to be standing in like a year's time or much less 3 or 4 months time?
Right. Right. So, you know, we can give assurance in like security guarantees and all this stuff, but really just by having America's name on things and us being so stable and like global superpower and stuff, that gives them assurances basically. And they can become insured. I mean, there's more to it than that, but we need to sell them weapons and stuff like that. And we need to, you know, I personally don't want to see a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. So we need to not allow Iran to get a nuclear weapon, because then Saudi Arabia and Qatar and all of these Gulf states are going to be trying to get one. And we don't need that.
That's not a good idea.
We don't need that. And so, you know, there's that. But the Gaza plan kind of just takes a hold of what is Hamas going to do in these negotiations? Are they going to give other hostages back, including an American and an Alexander? But I think there's 24 believed to be alive there. And then there's the bodies that they're holding hostage, which is just like so sin twisted and disgusting. And so what are we going to do? So if they won't get their act together, and it's going to take 15 years to rebuild Gaza, which is what they're saying, because it's they had that tunnel network and you have to fill in the tunnels and all that. What are we going to do with all these people who want to leave? So with those protests.
It was my impression, though, that some of those other places, I'm thinking specifically of Egypt, did not want to take But they would they then have to be basically told you will be taking them in from the United States, or like, how does that
work? Do you get people to take them, I guess, is the question.
Well, I mean, Egypt has taken in 200,000 Gazan refugees, but they make them pay $10,000 a head, and they're all hanging out in Cairo right now. So basically everybody who has been able to leave, who has the means to have been able to leave Gaza, has left Gaza. Now it's the people who are like stuck, who don't have any money. So we need to get them out. And if they want to get out, they're going to have to go through Egypt's borders. We have to set it all up and stuff. I think that they're going to set up some sort of camp in the Sinai. I think we won't have American troops protecting them. We'll probably contract private military companies. BlackRock seems to be like, what's mm-hmm. the guy who started that again? Peter something. He's doing a press tour a little bit, like a podcast.
Not Peter Thiel?
Not Peter Thiel, but he is a
No, film. I'm all, wait a second.
I'm blanking on his last name.
You saying BlackRock or BlackRock, the Eric Price guy?
Eric Price. Sorry. Yeah.
I was about to say, I think we're BlackRock, because they're the finance group. It was Blackwater. Water.
These all sound too Eric similar. Prince. I can't keep it all mm-hmm. straight. Thank you for correcting me.
Like, I'm like, BlackRock is in this,
I know,
too?
I to
what is going
like,
on?
They're, doing Black
they're everywhere.
Eric Prince, Blackwater. You're right. I'm sorry. We're going to contract these private military companies. They'll watch the one in Jordan. They'll watch the one in Egypt. And then Somaliland and Puntland want recognition. Like, they want to be recognized. The African Union won't recognize them for various reasons. So we won't if the African Union doesn't. Well, if we just say, hey, we'll recognize you if you take a bunch of people from Gaza, it sounds like they're willing to do that. So
who pays for all of this?
The Gulf states.
Do they, or do we?
No, they have enough
okay.
money. Yeah. They go.
So you're telling me that the Trump AI Mauro Gaza is not going
to
happen?
I don't know if it's fully. Well, first of all, I'm buying a condo there if it is happening.
It could be beautiful.
I've always joked.
How imperialistic of you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, like.
You are a colonizer. Thank you.
If China's going to do it, we might as well, too. We're better than China. So, yeah, I mean, if I think that probably what happens is 50 to 70% of the people who want to leave do, because it does not sound like Hamas is going to do anything else with these negotiations. The 30% that stay there, I don't know what we do with that. You know what I mean? I think that they maybe stay in kind of an area that's closed off. And then
I'm fascinated. I mean, I hate to bring it domestically, but I'm fascinated by the discussion that happens here in the United States. Some of the most progressive accounts, Trump talks about Gaza and the Riviera of the Middle East. And they're like horrified about the concept of these people being relocated and the area being developed. But then at the same time, there's no offer of what should be done.
Yeah.
And I was like, do you just feel morally better if they're like in a really crappy situation? Like, yeah. I just don't understand.
Yes. I think that that makes them feel great because then they can just complain forever and ever and look at how awful the situation
fundraise.
Is and we've done nothing. Yeah. And America's the worst for whatever reason for living in prosperity here. I do think that that moral superiority is a comfort to some people. I think they
don't like this is what the left has done is they've just they don't stand for anything anymore. They just stand against Trump. Even when Trump did good things like the Abraham Accords, which look like they're going to expand. Saudi Arabia will sign on to them and other countries will too.
So you think that'll return the Abraham, like it'll return full force Abraham Accords?
Yeah. I think we'll add a bunch of new countries. Indonesia, maybe Malaysia. I mean, a bunch of Arab majority or Muslim majority countries will sign on to it because Palestinian statehood, I mean, the two-state solution is just kind of that, unfortunately. I mean, it would have been great,
And I can't fathom how that would work out. Like, it's never, it's been attempted for as long as I've been alive, and every single time it's faltered, it's fallen apart, you know. And that's what's really fascinating is that this administration is facing so much opposition. However, you know, it's because they're doing something different and unfamiliar. And I feel like at some point you have to be willing to roll the dice and attempt something different and unfamiliar because clearly doing the same thing over and over again, not working.
Right. Well, and it's a weird thing on the left where they seem to think the more time goes by, the more likely it will be. The opposite's been true. I mean, it was like almost there in the 90s, in the early 2000s. Well, it's only gotten worse after the second Intifada. It's not going to happen.
Speaking of expansionism and kind of bringing it a little bit closer, what is going on with Canada and this 51st state? I'm really trying to figure out if this is trolling.
Amanda's smiling. She's
I know. Well, let me tell you, like, I have zero interest
in
Canada becoming
senators.
A state.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's the same thing, like, even for my own home country, even for Puerto Rico. I love my home. I love my island. But honestly, I would prefer for them independence more than anything. So, I don't understand why Trump is doing this whole, you know.
Tariff war.
Canada's governor, the 51st state. Like, we don't want them, do we?
Well, we don't want them, but we also don't want them to have such, we don't want them to be so in bed with China. And they are. And part of that is the Democrats.
Are they more in bed with China than we are? Like, are you talking about economically or how are they?
Well, I mean, for instance,
in bed with China,
there's these sand dunes in Alberta that have oil in them. And Canada would like to make money off the sale of that oil. And so we were going to build a pipeline called the Keystone Pipeline.
I remember. And Biden was like, no.
Well, it was under Obama. The Democrats will not allow that pipeline to be constructed. And same in like Pennsylvania, it flips back and forth. And so Canada wants to sell this oil. And they said to us, if you don't build these pipelines, we're just going to build one east to west and we're going to give it to China. So they have.
Well,
and they're,
that's
you
not
know,
good.
They're, yeah, we don't want that. We have trade agreements. I always mess up the acronym for it, but it's like the USMCA or whatever that Trump negotiated when he renegotiated NAFTA. We have first rights to that oil. We want to buy it, but we can't get the pipelines built, so they're selling it to China. that's what I think this is all really about. It's about the fentanyl, which is, you could look at it as asymmetric warfare potentially by the Chinese, the fentanyl crisis.
The argument is that it's like 1%. There's not really that much fentanyl coming out of there. So it's not like they don't think it's legitimately about fentanyl.
Well,
I don't like, I know that, like, because I think like 1% or like somebody was citing like it's a briefcase worth of fentanyl. I'm like, well, a briefcase worth of fentanyl can kill like,
yeah,
a crap ton of people.
A lot.
You know what I mean?
A lot.
So
of
I don't think like we should be dismissive. And I believe there's also reports that some of it is coming into the United States via like the dry van, like long haul transportation. So it's not even because they can just like, they have easier ways to cross the border. So it's happening in a different way than what we would see typically coming from the southern border.
Yes. Yeah.
Is that correct?
It's different. I mean, there are people who make the argument, and I'm not this crazy, but there are people who make this argument that basically China's engaging in like asymmetric, like non-traditional warfare tactics with their refusal to clamp down on the fentanyl trade. 2013, they realized they could make a lot of money doing that. Like just, and it's not like the Chinese government, it's like just people in China were doing that. So then we said, can you please stop? And China kind of looks at it as like, we'll engage, we're not going to change our laws, we're not going to do anything unless we feel like we have a good relationship with the United States. So they kind of use it as a bargaining chip, whether or not they're going to shut that down. So being that they, we can't trust them, and they're going to, you know, I mean, stuff got a little bit better under Biden in certain regards, and then it got worse in other regards. Being that they use basically, I mean, more Americans have died of fentanyl overdoses than every war since World War II. Like, it's a really big problem. So
that, are you saying that when you say like, are you saying like, you don't think it's China using it as an actual tool? It's more them just allowing it to happen and allowing their people to make money of it. And it's just a byproduct that it happens to be killing, you know, and affecting the United States the way it is.
Yeah. I don't think Xi Jinping is like, I'm going to do an opioid war to like 2.0 in America and I'm going to get everybody addicted to it. I don't think that at all. I think that he knows it's a problem. And he is only willing to fix the problem if we give him some of that, what he wants. Mm-hmm. And so that means that we need to have partners in Mexico, but also in Canada, who, okay, they won't deal with this problem. You need to help deal with the problem. You know, you can't let this like flow over our border and stuff too. And I think that that's kind of how we should look at that problem. But it's also the oil. And it's also, I mean, it's a lot of it. I mean, they allowed a lot of Chinese investment into like mining and things in Canada. We have first rights to all of those things under the trade agreement that they wanted us to sign. So
are they getting, are they just being like bad friends? Just kind of like Europe was kind of being?
Yeah.
Correct.
So is the Canada's going to be a 51st state?
Do you think it's going to happen? And do you want it to?
I don't want it to. I don't think it's going to happen. But I think that they need to kind of like, the economy grew so much when he was out of office. I think we used to be 4 times the size of Japan. Now we might be 8 times the size of Japan's economy. I mean, we just grew so much. We can flex our muscles economically way more. So why not threaten a trade war? Because it's much better than an actual war. And it'll get them to do what we want them to do because we're their biggest trading partner.
Can Trump, I mean, this is starting to move into economics, so I don't want to go too deep into it. Yeah. But like, can Trump sustain, and I'm talking about politically, I'm not talking about like, because I definitely think monetarily the United States, like if we're going to get into a trade war, like we definitely have the upper hand. But unquestionably, a trade war is going to, in some form or another, regardless of how the administration may want to sell it, is going to be felt in the pockets of Americans. Like politically, do you think, I mean, do you agree with that? Am I making an assumption? Or in politically, can Trump sustain that long enough to eventually get the result that he's hoping for?
I think a lot of this changed when Canada has their elections. And I don't remember the date off the top of my head.
I think it's in October.
Yeah. So I think a lot of this ends at elections. We hope the Conservative Party wins because they're going to be a lot less hostile than Trudeau's people. In terms of like, how will that affect us economically? It won't affect us as much as people say it will, honestly. Mm-hmm. Like, there are American companies that make the same products as Canadian companies that we could just buy that instead. You know, like, it's not really, like, it's not going to be inflationary as a whole because inflation is one an entire category goes up in price. Well, this would just be Canadian
items.
Products. Yeah. 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 So, specific brands and items. So, I don't want to get into a trade war with Canada, but I mean, we need them to start playing ball a little bit more on this.
Well,
and
if you're going to bet on who's going to win it, it's going to be the
US.
Obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, always.
I get a little bit more testy about like Taiwan, but yeah, no, we're fine against Canada.
Well, okay. So now overall, is Trump's strategy different this time around in regards to foreign relations? How he's trying to handle the world stage than his first administration because he just learned more? It's different. Or is it just more about how much opposition he faced the first time around that he wouldn't have been able to do what he actually wanted to do? Because he was talking about Greenland even the first time around.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that in his first term, I think he's pretty much on the same line, viewing China as our greatest geopolitical competitor, would rather use economic means rather than kinetic force, but is not immune to using kinetic force, wants to be a deal maker. That can be good, that can be bad. But he had these advisors who were going and talking to our adversaries and to our allies kind of behind the scenes. That's not happening so
like
much
literally.
This time.
Who was literally. It? Wasn't it Mark Milley that talked to China? Which after all of this Signalgate crap, I'm like, please sit down, shut up. I don't want to hear it because you literally had someone who was in the White House, who was a general, speaking to our enemy and being like, don't worry, I won't let the president, the commander in chief, do anything that would negatively affect. Like
Trump wasn't planning to bomb China.
No, of course not.
They're an adversary. We're hoping to never be in open hostilities with them. But
the whole idea that so many people are all of a sudden in the last 65 days extremely concerned about national security when we had a president who was not cognitively aware of what was even happening, but his administration and him were allowing thousands of people to just walk into our country for the last 4 years. And now Signalgate is what bothers you? I mean, I get it. It wasn't my favorite thing in the world, but I did not hear any of you talking about that national security threat. See what I'm saying?
Well, it's politics.
This is what bothers me, though. I mean, Biden's foreign policy blunders killed Americans. We lost five Americans at Abbeygate. We lost three at Tower 22 with the drone infiltration in Jordan.
Not one person was fired for that.
No one
and yet
was
they're
fired.
Wanting Mike Waltz to be fired like yesterday.
Yeah. Yes. The texting bad.
Not great.
We're cleaning up the mess Biden made in the Red Sea where 40% of Europe's imports come through. If we want Egypt to play ball and take in these refugees, one way we could do that would allow them to make revenue through the Suez Canal when they're broke. Yep. Global superpower. The whole reason we have a navy is to protect free, fair trade. And we haven't done that for the last year and a half. And I guess that would be my biggest thing that I have a problem with the premisists on is when they say, well, if we curtail at all on Russia, Ukraine, that's going to mean we're allowing China. We can go through foreign policy failures and still be seen as the world superpower. We allowed the Red Sea to be stopped for the last year and a half. We're still seen as a global superpower. If we do a Korean-style disengagement on Russia, Ukraine, we will still be seen as a global superpower. It's just insane that they try and frame it otherwise.
Right. I have two questions for you. Okay. And I mean, we could talk for another like 3 hours.
Yeah.
But I have two questions.
You can come back because this is fascinating.
For sure. No, I
you need
so
like the geopolitical moment with Amanda every month to kind of calm us down. My questions, I have two of them. First of all, my husband's family lives in Taiwan.
Okay.
So, and they have their whole life. His mom came here from Taiwan almost 50 years ago.
Wow.
But his whole family lives there. And so my question is, how deep is your concern for China
invading
basically
Taiwan.
Going back and reneging on like the understanding we had that America had that feel like our politicians kind of waffle on and wordsmith all the time and they're kind of always going back and forth with what they actually think? How much of a concern do you have of China invading Taiwan? And then my second question is, if you had to zoom out and say the top two things that you're concerned about on a geopolitical like level, what is your biggest concern right now? Like, what is the biggest concern you have in the present moment for America?
for America? China's pursuit of hegemony is my biggest concern, probably. I think that we've kind of come into this understanding when we say national security, that people think that means invading some country in the Middle East that nobody can find on a map. And that's national mm-hmm. security. And that's, I mean, national security means a threat to us and the homeland. If mm-hmm. if China can control 50% of global GDP, Europe is 10%, mm-hmm. by the way. So when everybody mm-hmm. freaks out about Europe, Asia's 50% or more, maybe, potentially. If they can control that, all of a sudden we're all working for Chinese companies. They can call up Google and say, oh, you can't have that video up there. I mean, we have problems with the social media companies now, but it's our understanding that American politicians can fix that. If we're all owned by China, you know, that's not.
Yeah, that's not happening.
It's not happening. And so that's kind of my bigger issue. Or that's kind of my number one problem. And then
isn't that happening a little bit with Europe? Like, aren't they kind of doing that to themselves? Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, you know, censoring mm-hmm. themselves and yeah. things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. If we don't like censorship, we've got a problem here. So we should, you know, we need to contain it correctly. That doesn't mean we need to pursue regime change or some sort of like all out war with China, but we need to show them that we're willing to play ball. When you talk about Taiwan, I am concerned. I'm less concerned under Trump. I think he's got enough of the madman theory. I actually think if we are like more disengaged from the Russia-Ukraine conflict, I think that's going to show China that look, we can solely focus on Taiwan. And I think it's become abundantly clear, like we would defend Taiwan. So now yeah. it's just like,
how... At least this administration, I feel like they definitely would. The past administration.
And even I even think Biden would have, I mean, we would have been overextended. We can't be in three theaters at once. We don't have the capability. If we build up our manufacturing base, the CHIPS Act happened under Biden. I actually think that was a good thing. If China invades Taiwan, they're kind of like going nuclear Taiwan would like kill all the chips manufacturing. And mm-hmm. so China would want to do that so that we can't win the AI race because we use all of those chips. Well, mm-hmm. now that we're going to start manufacturing them here, if they understand that we're going to have the chips regardless, that would slow us down if they invaded
that
Taiwan.
Disincentivizes
yeah,
them,
but it
yeah.
disincentivizes them for sure. So I think that was actually a good thing done by, I'll give them credit there. And I think that was bipartisan, but you know, so we have that to kind of look into. I think Taiwan's like prepared. They need to spend a lot more on their like defense. I mean, they should probably be spending 10% of their GDP on defense. They don't. So, you know,
do you ever see any kind of like, I don't know, kind of like, you know, Europe work, you know, is supposed to be working together to defend each other. The Middle East is supposed to be working together. I mean, they're fighting each other, but they're, you know, they're supposed to like work together. Like, do you see something like that in the Indo-Pacific? Like also, yeah, you know,
kind of
Taiwan, Japan, South yeah. Korea, you know, that region.
Yeah.
Would they maybe become allies and work together more? Like, is that something that should be encouraged? Kind of like they kind of have their own little NATO situation because of China?
I think that they do have kind of an informal alliance, not a formal one. But being that Trump was kind of on the madman, I don't know if we're going to stick in and defend you, even what they're seeing with like Russia, Ukraine. Obviously, they need us in our support. But I do think that they're kind of looking like if they all start spending more in preparing and getting mm-hmm. ready, that's a net good. Like, we yeah. don't need, that's a net positive. And I think that already exists. South Korea does a pretty good job. I mean, they contain the North Koreans and stuff. We still have troops there. I mean, Japan should spend more. Australia's getting better. Taiwan should spend more. But, you know, for now, I think we don't need so much like overwhelming like talking points of like, we're going to get China out of Taiwan and all that. Like, that's what we should not be doing. I think it's clear that we would defend them. I think what we should be doing instead is showing China, like, hey, we're not going to ice you out of the Asian markets. You're going to have, you know, bridge coal.
Like, you can do your own thing or whatever. Just stop messing with us, essentially. Like,
yeah, well, it's just, you don't need to control all of this. Because what would happen mm-hmm. if, well, Bridge Colby says this all the time, that, like, Xi Jinping's China, he's trying to pursue the like Stalin's view of, you know, what he was trying to do with pursuing communism in the Cold War, where like he basically had all these markets all around the world that he could sell the products that they made in excess to. Well, that's kind of what Stalin couldn't achieve that. Xi Jinping is trying to do the same thing. So China doesn't want to lose access to these markets. Okay, fine. You can have access to all the markets, but you can't ice us out of them.
Yeah.
So we just need to contain them. And so we can, you know, yeah, we're not going to hurt you economically, but don't invade anyone.
All right. Well, to wrap us up, I know we are very, very early in the Trump administration, like it's like two and a half months or so. Do you think his doctrine so far is on track? Like, is it on track? And obviously, we don't know whether it's going to be successful, but is it on track in a way that it's looking, you know, more positive or negative, or it's really just like too soon to tell?
Well, I guess it would be too soon. I think we're on the right track. We just have to see. I mean, we look back now and we realize, look, the world was felt way safer under Trump's first term than it did under Biden. But there were moments under Trump's first term where we thought North Korea was going to launch a nuclear weapon at us. Like there were times like we like everybody said that it was going to be World War III after he killed Qasem Soleimani, the IRGC, like, celebrity commander. Israel could not have had all of its successes now had Soleimani been alive. So I think that that's a big deal, too. But, you know, there were blips where we felt a little crazy and unstable. I think for these negotiations to work out, to like kind of, you know, finish, like have Israel finish the war in Gaza to their liking, where Hamas is no longer a military or political power. I think, and then ending the Russia-Ukraine war, we might have some blips going back and forth. Like, I don't know. We might see a little moment of escalation, but that moment of escalation probably would let our adversary know, okay, we mean business. We're serious. We're going to go through this. I feel like we're on a much better track with countering China. And I think that if Trump is a success this time around, we don't see nuclear Iran and we see an end to these conflicts and we see an increase in American manufacturing.
And he's going to get the Nobel Peace Prize that he wants.
If the liberals let him have it, maybe.
I mean, that's the whole thing. I am firmly convinced that Donald Trump could preside over like a cure for cancer. And they would be like, no.
No, none for you.
It's because of Biden's operation. What was it called? Rocket shot. I don't know.
I can't remember.
Okay, I have a question. This is kind of related. Just want to get your read on it, knowing what you know about and really focusing on Middle East politics. And you can say no comment if you'd like, but I'm going to make you answer. Okay. Do you think that Mahmoud Khalil should be deported?
I was like, she's going to say yes. And I also know that she's going to say yes because she talks about it over on TikTok.
Okay. See, I'm not on the talk. So this is all new to me. I feel like I like that. Okay.
My thing with the Mahmoud Khalil situation is like, I can't stand, and I don't understand. Liberals are so much, oh, we need to get money out of politics. No foreign influence. Okay. So you don't want AIPAC to exist or any of these CARE, like any of these, you know, what they would consider foreign influence. They're American political special interest groups on behalf, like, that want us to have relations with other countries, but whatever. They're so against that, but then they're fine with importing foreigners to come here and, like, try and undermine America. It doesn't make sense. If you're so mad about the money is, but you're fine with importing, like, campus agitators. What is that? Like, that's crazy.
Yeah.
No, like, I think that it's good that we're having these conversations again. I think liberals kind of ran immigration policy for so long of like, oh no, we just need to let people come here, you know, it's better for them, even though apparently we're such a racist white country. Why would we bring a bunch of non-white people here to be racist to, if that's what they think? I don't know. But like, no, we can have you guys, like, this is a little off topic, but have you guys been watching 1923, the Taylor Sheridan?
I've slowly kind of lost a little bit of interest in it because he like never gets home. So I haven't watched the last like episode or two, but yes, I have been watching it.
I just saw, I think, like 10 minutes of the first episode and then I fell asleep because I'm old and very tired.
You should finish it.
Okay.
You see a girl go through Ellis Island and how brutal they were to people going through Ellis Island. They like made sure that you weren't sick with anything. They would send women home that were 8 or 9 months pregnant back on the boat home because it's like, well, you have 2 mouths to feed, no job. Like we used to look at immigration as, how can you come here and make our country better?
How can you be profitable to the United States story and economy?
And so what exactly is importing campus agitators doing?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Well, and most of the time they're coming, they're getting their education, and then they go and take it somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Like even.
Well, they come here, get their education at some of the storied and elite colleges, and then they complain about how the U.S. and Western civilization is the worst. It's all very ironic, actually.
And I don't even know how we fix it, because I think some of these professors, and this is like a whole other tangent, but people just act like it's foreign funding. No,
it's embedded
in
there. Yes.
They believe it. And so I don't know how we fix it. But yeah, I mean, Columbia and Harvard and all of these colleges should be about producing students that make America better, not importing foreign students to say how America's awful and try and get like the next generation of these, what are supposed to be our best and brightest, fired up about niche issues that nobody, like honestly, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is kind of a niche issue. Israel's our most important
ally. Well, and it even wouldn't be a major issue on campuses if it hadn't been for October 7. Like, seven. Maybe amongst them, but I'm saying, like, at this level with the encampments and all the protests and, like, where it's become, like, a nationwide discussion.
Well, I guarantee not one of those students, maybe 10% of those students, even understood the conflicts that exist between Israelis and Palestinians before October 7th. None of them cared.
Not even now.
None of them knew any of it. And they don't truly, I think only a small percentage cared now. It's just like what the kids are going to do. I really believe that when I was watching it last year. Some do. Some actually could probably tell you what the river and the sea are. But most of them cannot. And so anyways, when you're looking at it, the visa issue and how that impacts us and our country, the homeland, do you love the idea of Trump's golden ticket visa issue? You do not like it. Tell me why.
I haven't seen how it's materially different than, I think it's called like an HCB visa. I don't know. There's a visa now that you can get. If you invest $800,000 mm-hmm. into an American company, then you get citizenship. So this, I think, just upped that to $5 million. It's not cash being paid that we can pay towards the deficit. From my understanding, it's they're going to go invest it in some real estate company and then they're going to build it. And so, I mean, sure, fine, and American investment if we vet the people properly. But I don't know. If we're going to use it to pay down the deficit, fine. But that's not my understanding. I think it's that you're investing in American companies. And I guess we need more flow of capital, so whatever. But no, I mean, I just look at like what the next administration could do with that. The other thing I'll say about the campus protest too, really quick. I've noticed like in my like just family and stuff, like people are less pro-Israel who have like gone through college and seen all of that just because they only hear the other side. But they also don't like the Palestinian, like the pro-Palestinian. Like they think they're like losers. Like these kids who like just go protest like for no, like for this, like that is like a massive turnoff. And I've been predicting that like there's kind of like this like kind of woke like monoculture.
Yeah, it'll like run its course, kind of like the trans situation ran its course and all that stuff.
Turns them off. So yeah, I mean, it's like a weird thing where like you'll go to a Black Lives Matter protest and they're all wearing keffiyehs and it's like, I don't really know what that has to do with this, but I think that's like turned people off. And so I think Gen Z is like very
well. Let me tell you, the progressive, like right now, the Democrats are clearly splintering between, you know, and the progressive side is really wanting to lean into it. So we'll see how.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm all for it. If you guys want to lean into it and splinter your party,
I mean, run another election on it. Great.
I'm fine.
I welcome
you wanna
it.
Take, if you want to take Cheers. Tim advice,
run Tim Walz again. That would be a great idea. I strongly support that.
All right. Well, do you have any other question, Rachel, before I wrap us up?
I mean, I have 1,000, but I
can't. Yes, but we'll just bring her back because we've already been here for over an hour.
Thank you so much for having me. I've had so much fun.
Oh, good. We love it.
Absolutely. Well, it was a lot of fun. I love to hear your feedback. We will definitely have you back because I am absolutely sure that over the next 4 years, we'll have
the
many
next four
more
years.
Things.
Like, I fully anticipate another Oval Office blow up. I can't wait. And we will just we'll keep you on retainer and just be like, we need a shot of Amanda. That's what
we need. We'll be like, we have to come and discuss about this. So thank you so much for hanging out with us. Make sure you guys check Amanda out. Give her a follow. Her accounts are going to be in the show notes. So make sure you give her a little bit of love.
And please come back, right?
Yeah, you're going to
come back.
Thank you so much. For okay. Having. I'd love to.
I'm just holding you accountable. I put it on audio now. Okay. I have evidence. Thanks so much, you guys. We will let you go. And here's a reminder to click that follow button, give us a 5-star rating, and leave us a review because it really helps the podcast grow. And make sure you tell a friend because, honestly, the algorithms right now hate us. So share us with a friend. And we'll see you again for another episode on Thursday. And in the meantime, let me remind you that the media is trash and we have no tolerance for it. All right. Bye.
Bye.